Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Luke Winslow King, whose latest album, Coast of Light, is out now. His 10th album overall, the record finds the former Michigan resident exploring a wide range of emotions and situations that never feel inauthentic and speak to the reach of both his imagination and lived experience. Now living in Spain, Winslow King recently discussed how he is forever finding new things within the songs he's written, his connection with his audience, and why he's always keen to record songs quickly in the studio. That's Luke Winslow King on Into Music coming up now. When it comes to making a record, is this something where, you know, you're one of those people where it's like, okay, this is the time on the calendar, I got to sit down and do 6 months of writing? Or is this kind of like a continuous flow of songs and then you go and select like the best ones from that batch?
Yeah, I would say the latter is true for me. I've never been one to, you know, go on a writing retreat or schedule time to write. I just made a decision long ago to kind of always be in, you know, to live my life as a writer and kind of always be available to the muse when she calls. So I'm kind of always keeping a running list of songs and of ideas and just kind of running to finish songs and flesh them out when the muse calls, and just try to, you know, be as available and honest and genuine about the process so that I can come up with an authentic final product. To me, it seems that if you force the time, if you force wanting to write songs and it's like showing up for you, that you end up with a less authentic product in the end. So I think when you live as a writer and you make that process more natural and authentic, the final song also ends up being coming off that way.
Do you remember kind of your first impulses to write?
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of always written out of necessity. It's kind of something that's followed me, you know, throughout life. I started out just wanting to be a guitar player, and was in rock and roll bands in my early teen years. And, you know, it started off that the band needed a singer and I knew the words, so I sang. And then the band wanted to try to do original songs, so, you know, everyone just kind of pushed me in the direction. Oh, Luke, you got some ideas, you can do it. And people kind of just always pushed me in that direction, and I eventually learned to love that role and to see myself in it. But at first it was kind of just, like I said, out of necessity. We wanted to make a record, we wanted to have some originals on it, so I figured I'd try my hand at it. And that was, you know, when I was probably 15 years old when I started writing my first songs.
Wow. When did you feel that you were good at it?
I still don't feel like I'm good at it. I think that's what keeps you growing and keeps you getting better. I'm being slightly facetious. Like I can start to enjoy listening to some of my own material and my songs once in a while these days. But it is something you really have to work at, you know, to be able to listen to your own music and listen to your own songs and enjoy it. It's a hard thing to do. So, you know, I push myself by being pretty hard on myself about the process, but it's ongoing. You know, you're always trying to push yourself to be better.
There's that thing about validation, right? Where it's like, I don't know about you, but at some point in my life, it was, you know, because I write prose, and, you know, at some point I heard two people say, you know, you're good at that, three people. And then at some point it was like,
I should probably start believing this.
Yeah. I guess you have to be careful who and how much you believe, right? And for what purpose. But, you know, I think I'm always kind of looking for that sense of purpose and what the songs are for, who they're for. Well, why do you do it? You know, and always kind of searching for that, not just with songwriting, but also with performance and living this life of a musician. Like, why do you do it, and who for, and why, you know? And I think that's part of the journey. It's part of the process, and I think that honest searching comes out in the music.
So there would be some people who say, oh, at the end of the day, I paint, I sculpt, I write songs, I make films, but I do it for me. But it sounds like you have this an awareness of audience, even if you're not always aware of exactly who the audience is.
Yeah, I mean, I know that they're there. I don't necessarily make a particular song for them, but I also understand that the songs are a part of the show, and when you get to the show, you have a responsibility to your audience, right? And the show is nothing more than amalgamation of the songs, right? So at a certain point, you're going to have that responsibility. Like, there's going to be people standing in front of you having bought a ticket, and I don't take that lightly. You know, I do the living as an artist as a privilege. And we do have responsibilities to serve our audience, like in any vocation. So, you know, I think the songs are a vehicle for that, and end up in that end of you know, in service to the music, in service of the audience, even if the audience is the muse who originally inspired the music. Even if it's an audience of one, even if you're your own audience, you know, you have to somehow please yourself with what you've finished in the end. So it's all part of that journey.
So to talk about, for instance, with this record, do you go through a process, like a pretty heavy revision process, like put down a song and then revisit it, within a certain period of time and say, okay, what was I hearing on that day? Does that still ring true today? That sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it usually starts out with parts, and then I take some of the winners and try to do like a final demo of those. And I usually won't bring anything out in the studio unless I have a pretty final demo of it. So it has to reach a certain process to even be in the running when it comes to the studio. And then when we get to the studio, I usually like to kind of throw the songs up in the air and see which ones land on their feet. Like, see what actually works with the band. And sometimes we'll completely change the feel, the tempo, the key, the style, just completely flip the tune on its head and see what actually works. Because we've come up with some really interesting material that way, taking a waltz and turning it into a rock and roll shuffle, you know, where the lyrics are kind of cast in a different light, and the rhythm and the feel of the song completely changing makes the band feel like they have something brand new and fresh. So I've had a lot of luck with that. So that's kind of the process. Like, I have a lot of ideas going in, but I'm also trying to make things seem as new and as free and as open as possible. Because I've been guilty in the past, or you know, it's been a part of my learning process to be over-prepared when I look back over my past albums and over the years. And you know, if you want to hire creative people in the studio to work and you want to get the best out of them, you need to allow them to create. And if they're just recreating a demo, then you're not really getting the best out of all the artists involved in the studio. So I've learned from that over the years to let people bring their best, let them take chances, and try to have everyone right on the edge. Usually, like the first full performance of the song, the first time you land on your feet is the best. Usually the second, or by the time you've gotten the song finished with all the words and all the parts correctly, the third or fourth time, it usually feels old already. So you really want to have your engineers and in your band and everyone ready to capture that first full performance on wax, and hope that that's the one.
So then, how is that different then? Because I mean, you said, like, maybe the fourth performance it feels kind of old, but then you got to go out and live with those songs for the next however many years. So there has to be a way, I would guess, of finding them fresh, for instance, each night or something.
Yeah, I mean, and then after the songs are recorded, often we end up playing different versions of them on the road after they come out on the record. So, by the time we've recorded the record, released it, and then we're on record release tour, it can be 6 or 8 months later, and already we can have a different feel or a different key or a different approach to the song. Maybe I'll play it in a different tuning, maybe adding extra verses or, ad-libbing on the words that are there. We try to keep a pretty standard set list, but I feel like, in my years in New Orleans, I've kind of cut my teeth growing up on the streets of New Orleans, playing in jazz bands and playing in clubs in New Orleans. And people there, they gig way too much to want to rehearse. So there's a certain style that's developed in the bandstand of like, all right, if everyone has their heads up and we follow this set of guidelines, maybe there's five or six general rules, then we can kind of get through any song without rehearsing. And I've kind of brought my bands around that approach, which gives you a lot of freedom, but you do have to follow those guidelines to make it work. Everyone has to be like their eyes glued to the band leader at all times to make it work, and has to have a certain vocabulary under their belt, to be able to make it look easy.
Presumably a different player. If you had to change drummers in the middle of a tour or something, that's like opening up a whole other universe of possibilities as well.
Yeah, it's got to be the right kind of person that could fill in. Drummers are the hardest to replace in the middle of a tour. But yeah, that's always a challenge, and we're always kind of trying to, populate the band with people that are of a similar upbringing musically and a similar training and pedigree of of a certain approach and a certain style of music. But I've been really lucky to have a lot of great players that understand that approach. It's been really tough in Europe to find European players that can do that. But I've been lucky to have a group of Italian guys who kind of came up, studying American music and spent enough time, in the States playing music there that they get it really well.
Well, I think that the record certainly and your records as a whole speak to this kind of diverse range of music that has influenced you. Certainly blues is in there, but it's also apparent to me that you've probably spent some time studying sort of the well-established writers who are, doing the, for lack of a better term, sort of American songbook kind of stuff. Is that how you kind of see it? Is that music is ultimately kind of one.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my heroes never really worried about what genre they were in, and just kind of wrote music that spoke to them. And that's kind of where I'm at. I feel there's an audience for blues festivals and for blues music that my music appeals to that audience, but I also don't feel, beholden to any one genre. So I kind of just, let the songs kind of come out and then, make sure that I'm really owning the style before I put it on a record. I'm not gonna come out with like a dub reggae song. Like that's just like a little too far outside the wheelhouse, And when I did go to Morocco and collaborate with, artists in the Saharan desert, like we tried to like take their style and mix it with something that we feel like we really know and we really have a good handle on the style and mix it into something that you feel like you can really own. So it's important for me to be able to branch out and to go into any style, but to be able to be an authentic voice in any style that you do choose, to be able to really get into it and understand the style. Because it's strange to me when you see an artist like every one of their albums is like a theme, right? And like the blues, and then the next one is old time rock and roll, and then the next one is like a Caribbean album, and then the next one is jazz. It's just a little strange when it's, like you're like the flavor of the month kind of thing. So I think you really have to spend some time making the music really your own. And I think that's why a lot of my albums have been a mix of different genres on one album is like, to make that a little bit more sincere rather than feeling like you're changing costumes for every album.
Oh yeah, because that can, if one is trying to show off kind of diversity or something, that can also backfire because people can start saying, well, who is this person really?
Sure. Yeah, and you know, and I think that's a question you need to ask yourself as you go too, right? You know, if your audience is asking it, then maybe you need to ask it yourself too. But ultimately, you know, I think it's more important to just kind of be honest and open and, you know, play the music that moves you, that speaks to you, you know. So if, you know, if I feel like I need to make a hardcore heavy metal album next, then I will. But I'll try to really get in there and own it and get to know the music really well before I dig in.
How much of that is about not only listening, but like really studying, tearing apart songs and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I did a lot of that in my 20s and 30s. I did a lot of studying. Not that I won't go on another tangent or another bender of studying now, but now I'm a little bit less diligent about that. I think I have a lot of work to do, traveling, recording, and doing music business. I have less time for like actually hitting the books, but I do listen to a fair share of music, and I feel like I'm kind of always studying the sound. I'm always kind of studying song form. I'm always kind of looking for like what mindset or what angle a song is written from, or how they organize the rhyme scheme, or how they approached putting the whole thing down, or you know, what was their approach in the studio for the production? All those kind of things I'm kind of studying as I go. But I guess I don't set, just like with songwriting, I don't set time aside to sit down and study it. I guess I'm just kind of always interested. Yesterday, I just like looked up all the information I could find about the Basement Tapes and trying to figure out, you know, what Bob Dylan and the band were up to, like what led them to make these songs, like what were they after? Why are these songs so different than all the other ones? Why does the album sound so different? They're like, well, we had a dog on the floor, we had the windows open, you know, it's a different vibe than being in the studio.
I mean, isn't it amazing how sometimes art can differ significantly just based on circumstances like that? Like, oh, we had this house and everybody would show up in the morning and make coffee and away we'd go.
Yeah, it's there's always, you know, seems to be a time and a place. You never really feel like you're in a time or a place when you're doing it, is the thing. You always look back and be like, oh, we really had ourselves a scene. There was really a time. There was really like a special feeling surrounding that session. There was some magic happening, but you never know when you're in it. So, you know, looking back over my past projects, I've also tried to learn from that. It's like you could be in the glory days now, you just don't know it. So you got to treat everything as if it's sacred in that moment, you know. Every take, every performance, every time through could be the one, you know. You got to treat it like it's special. There's no throwaways. If you end up playing a concert and five people show up, you owe it to yourself to give them your best performance as if there's, you know, 50,000.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I mean, so many times I've been at a show where there's, you know, quote unquote, nobody there, and I feel like I walk away getting, you know, one of the best shows I've ever been to.
Yeah, I think a lot of artists understand that sense of responsibility to their audience and how it affects your just, you know, your personal responsibility to yourself, you know. I mean, if you're not showing up and playing for the dead people, then like what right do you have to go play for 50,000 live screaming fans, you know, if you can't play for the dead people a few nights, you know.
And there's always, I think, too, that possibility of like, well, okay, you know, yeah. Right now there's 10 people in Ann Arbor, but the next time I show up, maybe it'll be 50.
Yeah, I mean, we all go through that at different stages for sure. Sometimes you come back and then there's 500, and then the next time you come back, there's five again.
You've been listening to a conversation with Luke Winslow King. His latest album, Coast of Light, is out now. You can learn more about him at his official website, lukewinslowking.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson.